I don't mind him walking around as long as he doesn't come up or...
Just tell him no.
Okay.
Those are the words.
Or go running on
there. But,
oh, good for you. I'm not like that
that's why we're a little bit behind the wall. Green Party.
No, but Enid could be there even if it wasn't a job.
So I'm streaming to the Green Party US Facebook page, if anyone wants to click. You can make comments.
Does that save it?
I can save, yeah, it'll stay, yeah. It always stays on that page, and I can also save a high-density version on my phone if I want to. But it'll be there ongoing. And this is a great new technology. I mean, I used to carry cameras and kits and all kinds of things.
What system do you use to live stream?
Just the Facebook page. You just do it right from your Facebook page. All of you can do it.
Or you can also use Periscope.
Right, but I mean, I'm sure there's other technologies too, but this goes right from your Facebook page.
Small clips, right?
You can also do that straight to a group page. Like if you're part of Jill Stein's president, you can live stream from that.
Yeah, matter of fact, if somebody is here that links to that, you might want to, you know, link to it.
I think it's an admin, hold on, let me check.
You can do that on Google. That's a recent development, isn't it, on Facebook? Because before it was like very expensive, I was going to have to access it versus.
Well, Sandra, if I were to link to this, like on a group page, how would I?
Well, it's on the Green Party US page.
So you can share.
And I can share that.
Right.
You can share it right now. Plus, everybody that's friends on the Green Party US page will get a notification as soon as I start going live, which is why we switched to this, because when we did it on live stream, the regular live stream channel, like we had to just do all these things to get people to come there, because they didn't know about it. Now our 50,000 followers are probably in the UK, we'll get notification. And you get to be serious. Right.
One more question. Is it okay if we take photos?
Does anybody?
No, I mean, the panel.
I don't care. You care?
No.
We don't care. Well, I guess I'll start off by, I have this invisible disabilities, and walking back and forth is really, I'm pretty much done. So that's why I am a little disoriented. So, you ready? Are you ready going? My name is Katia Gruna, formerly known to some of you as Cat Swift. Remington and I, Mrs. Remington, we basically, you know, over the years have been like told like why people need to deal with the oppression thing. This, you know, it's not, we all know that it's not the job of people of color to, you know, do these kinds of workshops necessarily on their own. And so we kind of sort of took up the mantle of being the white people to talk to the white people, and we know there's people of color in the room, and that's not to say anything about you specifically. It's just that that's sort of the purpose of this, is to have that conversation, men having the conversation with men about sexism, white people having a conversation with white people about racism. And that's kind of where this sort of form came from, was that idea. And so this is really not about being comfortable. If you're comfortable, then, because being uncomfortable is a perpetual state of existence for oppressed people. So we're going to talk, we may talk in some ways that feel really uncomfortable for white people or for men in this particular workshop. And that's the whole point, is to get you into that space of feeling uncomfortable, because our society basically makes it so that cisgender white men are comfortable, right? I mean, of course you come into the class issue, and we can get into that issue as well, but in general, even if you're a poor straight white male, you're still going to have less oppression than pretty much anyone else. So the first step to confronting oppression, we feel, is learning to be uncomfortable, to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. And if you aren't uncomfortable, you're not doing it right. Just like working out, you feel a burn, you can learn to get past the aversion and feel that discomfort as positive and enjoy the process of undoing the institutional socialization that we all get from birth, that is to discriminate against anyone who is not a straight, white, cisgender male. Even if you don't benefit from the institutions because, for example, you're a disabled white male, you're still culturally conditioned to believe that you're privileged. So,
yeah. I'm supposed to turn off their phone.
Yes, please turn off your ringers if you haven't already. And so the Green Party, well, how many of you are new to the party and aren't real familiar with the core values and et cetera? So a few people. Well, we have 10 key values, and the movement is really, really at the core is about recreating society to end a white patriarchal supremacist system, which is also capitalist. And unless we work on ending our own program behaviors inherited from that system, we're going to fail to create something new. And so the idea is to establish new ways of interaction that benefit, that are fitting of our key values and be reflected in the new paradigm and enable us to get to that place. And so, for example, this particular discussion about racism and sexism falls under 5 of the key values that are of the 10, right? So you've got nonviolence. A lot of people think that means like, oh, I didn't hit you over the head, so I'm not being violent. But words can be extremely violent, even if you're not swearing, right? You're not calling somebody, can I say this stuff on Facebook Live? You're not calling somebody a fucking bitch or something. You're still, like, the way you say things and the things that you say can be perceived as a threat to someone who is in a press class. And then respect for diversity. If we really want to respect diversity, then we need to respect the people and ideas that fall outside of that white power paradigm. And if we don't do that, then we're not sticking to our values. Feminism, of course, is not just, it's also about gender equality. So it's not just if you're, it's not just about sexism. Feminism crosses the board. There's a lot of things about white feminists tend to be oppressive towards women of color, and there's that whole aspect of that too. And so really, we need to come back to the core that this is about equality, that the feminist model is not about, you know, discriminating against anybody. It's about creating an equal playing field for everyone. Personal responsibility. Each of us is responsible for how we respond to people. We're responsible for how we treat people, and we need to make sure that we're taking that responsibility. You know, it's not like you're saying, "Oh, well, that doesn't fit. I'm not that thing because I don't think that way." That doesn't mean that you're not doing those behaviors. And so this is really about looking into yourself, and if somebody's saying, oh, well, that's a sexist thing or a racist thing, that you stop and take responsibility and say, wait, what happened here from me? What did I do that allowed that or that caused that person to feel that way? And that's kind of where we're trying to get people to start looking at. And of course, it all boils down to social justice, right? You can't have justice if you don't have equality. So, what did I forget?
There was an element that I was going to add.
Go ahead.
We've unfortunately found that as I'm sure everybody can see from the complexion of everybody in the room, that the Green Party, despite its best intentions at diversity, is not the most diverse group. And what we've found is dynamics, especially when white cisgender men are mostly in charge, that even with the best intentions, we can create oppressive dynamics. which is why we're doing this, because I'm sure that there's not a single person in this room who wants to think of themselves as sexist or racist. But one of the premises that we've found is that it is impossible to live in a sexist or patriarchal white supremacist society without having some of that rub off on you. And so in the spirit of trying to work within our communities, this is what we're essentially trying to do. And part of this is because while we're not necessarily speaking on behalf of any oppressed people, what we've found is that for decades, or actually centuries, oppressed people have spoken up and have not been listened to. Part of the more subtle elements of patriarchy and white supremacy that we've found is that white folks tend to be a lot more receptive to white folks, and men tend to be more receptive to men, which is why we've decided that it's, that we're going to take the responsibility of trying to work on this in our own community amongst people who we feel we can create more of a feminist and anti-racist space.
So, one of the trends, so just that's kind of an overview of where we're going with this. And then, so now we're going to kind of do a, what do you want to call it, a grounding sort of get connected exercise. And Khadija is going to lead us in that.
Yeah, I'm Khadija Tatum Amir, and I've only been active in the Green Party for about 2 years, maybe a little bit more. My background is coming from more of a tribal kind of feeling. So we decided to put the two ways of dealing with things that might be uncomfortable coming from two different places. My space, I'm going to call it my space, is one of centering. And I want to say, first of all, if you guys are uncomfortable on an emotional level, on a physical level, this is going to be uncomfortable. It might get uncomfortable. We are not here to try to hurt anybody's feelings. But if your feelings get hurt, it might happen. It might happen here. Your feelings might get hurt. So if you're not ready to have that maybe happen, please. We're being for real.
No shame in it. We understand, like, it's going to be an emotional thing.
Yeah, but it might be uncomfortable for you. We just want to say that up front. Okay, what I would like for everybody to do is really, I know chairs are not the most comfortable places to be, and normally I would take a group outside and have them just sit in the grass, but as you guys feel out there, it is like fucking hot.
That's oppressive.
Yeah. So we don't want to be that uncomfortable. So if you would please just put yourself in a relaxance. Just sit back, please. Relax your body. Take in a really nice deep breath. Kind of visualize your breath coming up from your feet. Laying down is good if you're in a position where you can lay down. That's actually better. You want to actually visualize your breath coming up from your feet and through your center. If anybody has done any kind of meditation, it's kind of akin to the relaxation that you have to get to before you begin that process. So you want to take a few deep breaths, really deep in, and then blow it out through your nose, and in through your nose, or you can do open your mouth as well and blow it out. Don't open your mouth to breathe in. Just breathe in through your nose. You can open your mouth to blow out. So we just want to just really just let go of whatever happened 15 minutes ago, 30 minutes ago, an hour ago, yesterday, last week. We want to just kind of rest your body, rest your shoulders, relax your jaw. Really good technique for relaxing your jaw if you're jaw tends to clench like mine does, is to put your tongue to the roof of your mouth behind your top teeth. That's a really good exercise for letting you. I suffer from TMJ dysfunction, so it's something that I have to remind myself to do all the time. Because people tend to hold their tension in their faces, in their shoulders, in their hips, and we kind of just want to just let it go. Just relax. Really relax. And we want to just do that for a few minutes, a few good breaths in and out, and in and out. And then you want to hear your own heartbeat. I'm going to stop talking for a minute and just tune into your body so that you can feel your heart. And then after you're feeling your heartbeat, hear your heartbeat. You can actually hear it if you're quiet enough. Organizers, sometimes we forget that it's the earth that we are part of, but we have this disconnect that we do. But we do this disconnect with the planet, and then we do the disconnect with each other, which enables us to do things to each other that are not so good things to do, like be suppressive or oppressive or abusive. And so the first thing we want to do is connect back with the mother and then connect back with our hearts and our own breath and feel ourselves, because we can't get to feeling anybody else if we can't feel us, ourselves. It's just an unrealistic expectation. If you cannot feel yourself, you cannot feel anybody else. And we do this work that we do for love of the planet and love for our fellow man and love for our fellow being, whether it be a roach or a butterfly, okay? Because it all works together, the diversity. It's what makes us rich. It's what makes us special. And so we have to acknowledge ourselves in that special space. We are special, we are, all of us, in our different shades and tones and colors and hues and attitudes. We are so special. So we have to feel that in ourselves, and then we're able to appreciate the beauty in other people before we see the difference, see the beauty first. If we walk that way ourselves and try to do that, consistently. Does that make sense? Okay, so we want to do that grounding thing before we ask a question.
Do we
want to
address the question with the privilege exercise?
Okay.
So we're going to change it up a little bit. We have how many of you have actually done these privileged solicitation exercises? So since we're confined, it may not have as much of a visual impact, but we're going to do it by raising your hand.
And I can put it down.
And maybe we'll just keep track of like a rough guess of like how many people are fall into the category. Normally you would line up in this exercise and you take steps forward and take steps back. And that way at the end you've got a spectrum, right, where you can see where you are.
And I can say I actually did this once with a group of women, and I thought that several of the women in the room were way more class privileged than me, because currently at that time they were way wealthier than I ever have been. And in the end, I was the one out in the front. I was the furthest out. I was also the youngest, so, you know, having a grandmother that went to college wasn't a, was sort of a thing. Anyway, so the, so we're going to modify this a little bit. So
if we keep it valid, it should depersonalize it so that nobody feels singled out.
Right.
We can tally for ourselves, and then we can all just keep track of that on our own.
That would work well as well.
So the big part of this is actually to be in touch with how you feel during the exercise. Do you feel ashamed that you were part of a group that took a step or that raised your hand or didn't raise your hand? Did you want to be a part of that group that raised their hand or didn't raise their hand? So that's we kind of want to get into like how we feel when these questions arise. Okay, so few white people in the history of the U.S. have ever been convicted and executed for killing a person of color. All white persons raise your hand. That's like four of them.
What are we raising your hands for?
If you're white.
If just if you're white.
Yeah.
It's not a agree or disagree case.
Right.
We didn't have to kill anyone.
How many dogs did you murder someone?
What if it depends on the state?
What is it? What?
Depends on the state you're in.
Does whether you're white depend on the state?
How do you self-identify? Because if this is a question about self-identification, then are we going to lead into the discussion about what white is or why people would group together as white?
If you're of European descent and not of Native American or Mexican or any other indigenous group or African or Asian, then you're white.
That's different because I prefer not to self-identify as white.
I agree with that, but I understand the question.
Because it's oppressive. The only reason to group together as white is to be separate from those who aren't white, and then that'll make...
That's so outstanding. That is so cool.
If anybody's in doubt, I assume we should probably defer to how are you treated by
the majority
of the time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
That's a lot better.
That's a fair
question.
Those
depend on state
white.
And
that's a
federal
question.
Law.
So how many people do we have in here?
I don't know. How many
people?
That was
like 27.
There were
14.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did not
know.
Yeah. So the high school dropout rate for Latinos, Native Americans, and African Americans is over 55%. Latinos, African Americans, and Native Americans take one step back. So I guess how do we do that?
Minus.
Raise your hand if you're Latino, African American, Native American.
I made like a below and above the line thing.
Yeah.
So that's how I'll keep track. Yeah.
Minus so 7 below the line, 27 above the line. If you walk into a store, the workers suspect you're going to steal something because of the color of your skin. Raise your hand and you'll go below the line. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If you can avoid those communities or places you consider dangerous, raise your hand. Take one step forward.
Say the question again.
If you can avoid communities or places you consider dangerous, raise your hand.
Currently, that's...
The whole world's
you're able to...
I'm going to live in a neighborhood.
Like churches?
Currently.
Generally.
Currently, you're living in a safe community.
Okay. Currently.
What do you mean by safe?
It depends whether it's your daytime or night.
We're in the gang territory, but it feels safe there, so I don't know.
Cool.
And I did visit my mom's church sometimes, and I just...
Well, this is part of that whole, like, how do you feel about these questions?
Yeah.
It's like... And I don't even make up this shit.
No, yeah. Here's the messenger.
Yeah. I just borrowed this from a workshop today.
But this is a great thing.
Yeah.
Have lots of...
But this is, it's really not a good for...
There are lots of gray areas.
You're supposed to do this with your eyes closed and not have conversation and just kind of think about it's reflective exercise, not a debate, not a discussion. If you or your ancestors have ever learned that because of your race, skin color, gender, or ethnicity, that you are ugly or inferior, take a step back. Raise your hand.
What did I didn't get that one, please.
If you or your ancestors were taught that because of your race, skin color, gender, ethnicity, that you are ugly or inferior. African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, Asians, and women have been denied the right to vote in the U.S. White males take a step forward. Raise your hands. White males.
What was the question?
White male.
There was
white
no question. It's
are you
saying
a white
that
male?
Not today.
That all people but white males were denied the right to vote at some point. If you're a white male, take a step forward. If you or your family has ever received welfare, Medicaid, or food stamps, take one step back. If you have ever been called bad names because of your race, ethnicity, gender, or skin color, take a step back.
What was the question?
If you've ever been called names because of your race, ethnicity, gender, or skin color, take a step back.
Or even a disability.
Yeah.
What about sexual orientation?
That should be included.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sexual orientation and disability.
I'm sorry that we didn't include that.
Some of the people watching the stream are raising their hands.
Yeah. If you or any member of your family has been treated for depression, alcoholism, or drug abuse, take a step back.
Or loved untreated, shall we?
Yeah. Treated or untreated, especially untreated.
Okay, that's just about the whole group, too.
Well, why do you think we're here, huh?
If you live now or have ever lived in a home where drugs are sold on the street or near your home, take a step back.
I'm sorry, what was your question?
We've got a little bit of talking right here.
If you live now or ever lived in a home where drugs are sold on the street or near your home, take a step back.
Does that count marijuana?
Ever?
I don't think it should.
No. Marijuana doesn't count. We're talking
it's not really a drug, is it?
Cocaine, heroin.
Yeah, I lived down the drug blocks in the pharmacy.
If prior to your 18th birthday you took a vacation outside of the United States or your native country if you're foreign, other than Canada or Mexico, take a step forward.
Say that one more time.
If before your 18th birthday you took a vacation outside of the United States, other than Canada or Mexico, take a step forward. If you were born in another country, same thing applies. If you were born in Mexico and you traveled, took a vacation before you were 18 to, like, Europe, take a step forward.
Does this mean any travel or leisure vacation?
Vacation.
Before 18. Before
but
you were
leisure
18.
Vacation or any travel at all?
Any travel.
Any travel. If as a child your parents keep or kept over 40 books in your home, take a step forward.
More than 40 books in the home. Well-read people.
But think about how many people don't have books. Doesn't it?
We grew up in a rainforest.
That's not 40.
Yeah.
that if you were raised in a home where a daily newspaper was the only way to take a step forward.
I mean,
if you watch most programs on TV and see members of your race or ethnicity take a step forward.
Say that again.
If you on TV, most programs on television see members of your race or ethnicity take a step forward.
Did you say most public?
Most.
How about if you can think of
BET doesn't count, like on regular TV, like not a specific channel like that. African Americans, Native Americans, Chinese, and Mexicans were slaves in the United States. All those whose ancestors were not members of these groups take a step forward.
Can you say that again?
I want you to say every single one of them again.
No,
because she does repeat every single one. So
African Americans, Native Americans, Chinese, and Mexicans were slaves in the United States. All of those whose ancestors were not members of these groups take a step forward.
You mean all of them or some of them?
Any
of them.
Not members.
If you are not Native American, Chinese, Mexican, or African American, raise your hand.
There we go.
Okay, so do we have some kind of look?
Idea of where we're going.
Yeah, that was the idea. That was the idea to try to see, try to get a feel for everybody's experience. And if we have a group like this, so everybody here has experienced, most of the people here have experienced some type of oppression, some type of suppression, some type of, this is what I'm going to call it, it's ignorance. That's the base of it.
But we've also, most of us, experienced some forms of privilege as well, because almost everyone grew up with books. Almost everyone is white. You know, there's some good and bad. So it's like this particular group has more experiences with both sides of the aisle, as it were.
So, and perception, in terms of your perception, maybe that's what qualifies a green person. Your perception is maybe broader than a person that's non-green. Maybe that's what draws you into the, you know, our key values, you know, that you've experienced certain things already, mm-hmm. and those other things, those other groups out there, you don't fit. You're like mismatched. You're like a circle trying to be stuck into a square peg, and it just doesn't work for you. So maybe that's how we got to be in this space together, because we've had this
experience,
these shared experiences. So in seeing where we are and having a feel for the people in the group, I think that people would be comfortable enough to go to the next step. How much time do we have left?
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
How many people are from Houston or really close to here in this room? Okay. That makes a difference, because it means that we actually came here for this reason, and it shows like a common purpose or commonality. I was just wondering.
That's a really good question. Thank you for asking. Thank you for sharing that.
So somebody else has a question.
I just thought, to your point about sort of what brought us here and, you know, how like-minded people come together, I thought it was really interesting how many of us had, for instance, had families on welfare or with drug addiction, but also grew up with more than 40 books in our home. And I think that's sort of part of, it speaks to how we fight this battle, that, you know, regardless of the other circumstances in which we live, if we can all be educating each other, we can all be learning each other's history and our own history, then we can move forward, even in the face of things like poverty and addiction.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's a really good, conclusion to draw from what we just did.
Is there anybody else that wants to provide some feedback about how they felt during the exercise? And we didn't go through all of them. There are 41 questions. It was taking too much time.
So do you have...
Just something really quick. I we actually really appreciate that you did this. I think I learned something about myself. I am a queer white man, and I'm also from Irish descent, and so I have these stories that I tell myself about, you know, both how I'm privileged, but also how my people have experienced oppression, and I think it's really helpful to think about the broader picture, you know, because I tend to focus on queer issues, and I tend to focus on, you know, Irish history and revolution and all that stuff. So this was very helpful for me. Thank you.
This made me feel like we're all interconnected in some way. We all have some type of similarity. It also helps me to feel that although I'm like super mega oppressed, I do have privilege as a male, so.
That's pretty cool. It breaks my heart to think about people with no access to books. And so I feel like that's going to be something that carries me forward in my vision of how to share.
We need to talk.
I do a bookmobile suddenly. I just want to be the bookmobile.
We'll see what happens with that.
I was uncomfortable. It was hard for me to answer some of the questions. And I realized toward the end that I consider myself white as camouflage. My identity is not white. It's like, this helps me do things, but it's not who I am. So I have that conflict going on. But I have the option of picking and choosing, so that means I do have that basic privilege. I recognize that. But also there's some dissonance, yeah, so a bit of a split.
Privilege at the cost of erasure.
Okay.
That's really interesting, Kent, that you say that, because I've never encountered somebody that looks white, and I mean, for all intents and purposes, people looking at you would say that you're white if they haven't been around Native Americans enough. But to me, you're Native American. But there are a lot of African American people who who are biracial or multiracial, and they pass for white. So it's really interesting that you say that you do that. And I think you don't have to.
I felt that I had to. So.
Yeah, obviously, but it's just really interesting that you say that you're saying that, and it's really brave of you. Oh. Also, it's very brave of you.
Kind of to go off of that, I mean, I was born and raised in Mexico, and I mean, I don't think I look Mexican at all, so I think it's or what people would consider Mexican, and I think it's good to distinguish between like white privilege, American privilege, you know, white passing privilege, and because they all come with like a lot of different things, because I still benefit extremely from, you know, white privilege here and in Mexico. But maybe, you know, I don't have some privileges like as an immigrant, even though I came here when I was, you know, like 8 years old. So, and you're a woman. Yeah. So.
I it was very interesting when you asked the question if your house has had 40 books in it, because I mean, I felt I've always benefited because I'm white, but my parents came, and their parents came very, very poor. So we never had books in the house. And it was a very extremely dysfunctional family, to the extent that I had to totally leave it in order to have a life, you know. So it's so interesting, 40 books.
Expressing what we need to have happen here, and I think as Greens, we have huge opportunity as well as responsibility to lead by example, you know, to show how honest we can be with each other, to show that we do connect, that we can connect, that we're willing to connect. And there are so many people that just shut down when you even a little tiny bit expose, you know, a piece of a truth that they might not even be aware of. They're just like, oh no, you did not say that to me. If they don't want to engage in debate, they just click, no, I didn't hear that. or argue with you, or even actually become abusive with you, that could happen also. But that this group in specific is willing to share on that level, I think that really, I'm hopeful. it feels good. It's a good feeling, and it good to see, you know, that happen.
I was just going to say something I've become to perceive in multiple workplaces where I've worked, is I remember working as a pharmacy tech, and I have gray hair, I'm a man, I'm behind the pharmacy counter. The pharmacist was a recent graduate, was female and looked young for her age, and everybody who would come to the counter would constantly come to me. I eventually got laid off. I think the situation was uncomfortable for both of us, because the presumption of the people come to the counter was always that I should be the person. And some of the people would insist on speaking to me when I am not qualified to speak to them because of their presumptions. And it made me far more aware of, and I've been in other situations where people have come to me because I look like the oldest person there, or male. I'm the male, white guy, gray hair, and they presume I'm the person in charge. So they come over to me, and I'm like, no, she's in charge, and, you know, and she's an African-American woman, and like, da-da-da-da, but like, they constantly having to redirect questions, and sometimes I wouldn't get it, and I'd just go, if I knew the answer, I'd just go ahead and answer their question, and then I realized I really need to redirect this, because they're coming to me because of something. This needs to go to the appropriate place.
That's really great.
In any situation.
That's really wonderful that you recognize that and redirect, because I've been in that situation of being an African-American person that somebody's ignoring because my partner is a Caucasian man. And so everybody's talking to this Caucasian man instead of, I'm here. Yeah, so I've been in that position, and for you to be conscious enough to do that is a game. It's speaking highly for you being a green, you know, to feel like that, to think like that.
That one situation just really hit me over the head with it.
Yeah, sure.
Sanda,
well,
I think you're coming
in. Yeah, I just wanted to comment where you were saying about people being willing to be open. A couple of years ago, I asked to stream an event like this at a national meeting, and I was told I couldn't because it was very private and people were going to share their deep feelings and people wouldn't want to be on live stream, and y'all knew I was going to do this, and nobody objected to it. Nobody's objecting to
it shows we are evolving. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We are evolving. That is, yay! We are evolving.
Michelle, I just wanted to speak to what you were saying. I think that's a great example of how, you know, as a white man, you are actually also oppressed by the racist, misogynistic system, because it causes you to be in a position that you have to, you know, like you said, redirect, and you have to address that within yourself. And then perhaps it contributed to being laid off. You know what I mean? And so, I mean, I don't know that circumstance, but it's really important for us to all understand that, you know, even though I'm a white person, the expectations that are placed on me by society in being white are not always fair to me. And the expectations placed on you in being male are not always fair to you. And so, and you know, as when a lot of guys get together, they're expected to be sort of bros and like, you know, jokes are funny and stuff, and I don't know, but you know, that's not the reality. And then for people to have to navigate that, you know, it affects all of us.
And a couple of things apropos of a similar situation that you had. At one point I was a reporter and I was going to be interviewing Senator John Conyers, and I was to meet him at a hotel dining room, and I went up to the maitre d' and I said, I'm here to meet with Senator John Conyers, and so would you let him know I'm here? I kind of assumed the maitre d' would know who he was. He went all around the room, came back to me, and said, I don't see anyone in this room who looks like a senator.
What's the senator?
Senator John Conyers was in the room, and so I pointed him out, and then he said, oh, okay, and he took me over to the table. My other point is, I would like to make a distinction between being a victim and feeling like a victim. Because I've had a number of experiences, especially professionally, where in fact someone would say I was a victim of discrimination or something. But if you don't let it unempower you, if you don't feel like a victim inside, if you feel that you can move forward, you know, I don't know where that came from in terms of who I am, but I can honestly say for all of the discrimination that has come at me for various reasons, not just being a woman, I've never felt like a victim. And it's critical to moving forward.
It really is.
Yeah.
I can really relate to that. As a child, I think I had to step over that. Because I was a gymnast, and I'm 55 years old, and being an African American gymnast back then, it was not, you know, didn't happen. It was very rare. And I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and that's where I was, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. That's Deutschland. I was really slamming the competition because there had never been an African American gymnast in any of the schools, high schools, junior high schools, and I started to place consistently first and second and first and second in every single meet. And finally the judges found some way to discredit me by snipped off two sixteenths of a point to take my first and second place standing, because the school that had predominantly ruled in gymnastics for 50 some years was getting bumped by this little skinny little brown skinned girl that had cornrows, and they came up with this little thing in their supposed rule book that I couldn't wear cornrows. I couldn't wear cornrows. And
so Derek could have.
But you had to have your hair, you had to have your hair up. And so part of my hair was, I used to have hair down here, and part of my hair was cornrowed, and the other part was just natural. And they shaved the points off of my score so they could bump me to third and keep Bayview High School, that's the ones, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at their first and second holding places. And I was devastated. This was the first time that it had happened to me. I was totally devastated by this. And I went home and I was crying. And my father said, we have to jump higher. We have to run faster. Mm-hmm. We have to be smarter. Mm-hmm. We have to be, and he just went down this whole list of how we have to be so much stronger and better. And it was like, never again. That's what that did to me. That's what that experience did to me. It's the first time and the only time I felt like a victim. I mean, so many things have happened to me since that, but it didn't hold me down enough. I just got up 30 minutes earlier and I would run my little skinny ass to school and work harder in the gym, and they never could bump me again. They took off my points, but not enough so that they could. So I was. I took my father's little, you know,
you worked harder and made up for it.
I did, but that's the way I had to overcome, you know, that I knew I was stronger and that I knew I could do, you know, my best and not be slighted, you know, in any way. So I can totally relate to that. There is something that some button that gets pushed that says, no, I'm not going to take that.
Somebody's
leaning
against the light fixture.
Light switch.
I too was really moved by the books part. That was really a powerful insight for me, and I noticed tears because
I am Caucasian, but I grew up with alcoholic and drug addicted parents, and we had no books. And I remember another workshop where they said, "What did you talk? What current events did you talk about at the dinner table?" And it was like supposed to be sort of a revelatory experience. And I sat in the corner and I thought, political current events decisions. I mean, literally, we had knives and guns and fights and craziness. But what I want to say about my privilege, my skin color is a privilege. So even though I came from that background, I ended up in a children's shelter and a Catholic orphanage. In the orphanage, I was educated by the nuns. I read my first books. My mind was given space to grow. And once I had education, then my white privilege clicked in. Really, it's what happened. I was the first in my family to go to college and then graduate school, and I was socialized into the middle class. So education plus my white skin, plus the socialization into the middle class through that education. From that point on, there are so many stories I could tell about taking responsibility for my white privilege. Up until that point, I was a tossed child. And if we hadn't been extracted from that hot mess of an alcoholic, drug-addicted home, it would have been a very different outcome for me. Where the only white privilege I want to acknowledge here, and there's so many that I could talk about, is in employment. Because I have a master's degree, I have white skin, I went to Princeton, another place of privilege. You would never know that from my background. So it's very different. But at a certain point, my background is invisible. And I was hired in jobs that once I got into them, I said, I was not the person who should have been hired for this job. I was hired to work in Santa Clara County in California as a white female. The person who should have had that job was somebody who was multilingual and brown or black skin, not me. And when I realized it, I had to count the cost, and I'm sharing this really honestly with you. It's like the cost of a really good paying job. But I went to the folks at the agency I worked for and I said, I am not the one for this position. If you give me a year, I will identify someone much more appropriate who is multilingual and who has the life experience of the folks we're working with. And basically the agency instituted a whole new program of sort of getting us white folks to begin to transition more appropriately to what needed to be in that agency and in that community. So I gave up, you know, my economic privilege, you know, a salary of like, you know, $75,000, which for a girl child who came from my background would seem to be the pinnacle of success, but it was the pinnacle of privilege. That's what it was.
And that's perfect to segue, because that was you recognizing your privilege and then giving it up because you weren't qualified, as opposed to someone who'd be like, well, it doesn't matter, you know? And so
to courage.
Yeah.
To courage.
Oh, so gonna try to sort of transition from this into how many of you are familiar with nonviolent communication techniques?
What?
Nonviolent communication techniques. Marshall Rosenberg is one of the most popular. A lot of this has to do with listening to stories, right? If somebody's hurt by something that happens to them, they feel it's racist or sexist, then, you know, people tend to get defensive, right? Or especially people who are philosophically egalitarian, right? If you think in your head that you're not sexist, you're not racist, you're not ageist, whatever, it's really hard to hear somebody accuse you of doing something that's racist or sexist. It just is. And so part of the undoing the oppressive behaviors is to be able to stop your defensiveness and to hear what the other person's saying and acknowledge what that person's saying. We had I'll give you a good example. Green Party of Texas State Executive Committee meeting, 2004-ish. We had an incident where the moderators were me and my co-chair, and a woman said that was a really sexist thing to say, and the man got real defensive and said, I'm not being sexist, and it just started to be this back and forth, right? And we were caught off guard and we're like, okay, wait, what happened? Let's deal with the situation. But nobody wanted to tell us what was said. So we just took a break and we went for a walk, and what ended up happening was, it was quite magical actually. I talked to a woman and said, I just need you to stand with me and let me talk to the men. And when we came to the end of our discussion, we were standing there and the men had created a circle with us. And so this was my lesson to them, and this is what I tell people all the time, is that if a woman says that you're being sexist, then a man needs to tell the man, okay, stop arguing, and let's figure this out, right? Because a man's going to listen to a man telling him to stop talking, other than a woman saying you're being sexist, right? Because they're just, this person's being defensive, you've created this animosity, this conflict, and so it's just going to escalate. And if women join in on it, then the man just feels like he's being ganged up on, right? But if the men come to the man and say, no, look, let's deal with this, you know, maybe it was sexist, maybe it wasn't, but we need to address it because this is a problem. And we've found that that kind of behavior pattern really works well, because the same thing with racism, right? If I say something as a white person and a person of color says, that's fucking racist, and I just get into an argument with them about how it's not racist, then I'm not helping them, I'm not helping myself, I'm just creating more of a conflict. And then I would hope that, you know, David over here would come over and be like, dude, you need to chill the fuck out. Like, really, like, and I'm sorry, I'm swearing too much, I'm just too tired.
That's being who you be.
I swore on TV last night too, so. But, you know, and it's really about that, like, we need to, like, because, you know, I grew up with a really racist family. Really. Like, they're still racist. And I find myself, like, thoughts will pop into my head, and I'm like, what the hell did that, where'd that come from? And then I remember, oh, yeah, my grandma said that, or my grandpa said that, or my uncle said that. You know, we learn these things, we automatically see somebody, we judge them just based on what they look like. Same thing happens with, you know, I mean, this is any oppression, so it happens with gay people, and straight people, you know, disabilities, which is what we're going to talk about in half an hour. So basically what I'm saying is that when we create that defensive behavior and you try to debate somebody about whether or not something's racist or sexist, you're actually moving into a bullying type situation, right?
Yep.
And you actually are bullying that person because you hurt, they were hurt in the first place, and now you're ganging up on them. And so this is the kind of behavior that people of color and women in this movement, in this political party, this political movement, have been saying for well over two decades, that there are people who will not crack open their brain enough to hear these things and to look at these institutional socialization that they've acquired and look at their own privilege and stop the bullying, stop the defensiveness. And so this is where NVC really is helpful. There's three aspects. It's feeling, needs, and requests. And so,
observations.
Feeling, observations, feelings, needs, and requests.
That's
is
right.
that the order?
That's well, no, I think it's
feelings,
observations,
needs,
observations.
But I think it comes, you can put it in all
it's a
forms.
Circle, right?
Yes.
These are the four aspects. So, you know, an example would be like, I say something to Hadija and she tells me that I'm being racist, right? Which I don't think it's happened yet, but then my first response really should be, okay, what did I do here that is causing her to feel?
How did I offend you?
Yeah, how did I fail you? What did I do, right? And it's the difference, and we've found that people who have been traumatized as children or had to deal with abusive relationships immediately blame themselves for like, oh, I caused this, what did I do wrong? And that's not the where we're going with this. Where we're going with this is an honest, like, I'm not a bad person, but you wanna?
And there's an element about owning this stuff that's fairly crucial. It's fairly common for people to apologize when being called sexist or racist to say, I'm sorry you feel that way, which transfers the responsibility. It's kind of a cowardly way of saying you're misinterpreting the thing that I said. And that's it's very important to consider how we react. Rather than wording things or thinking of the person who has been hurt by the racism or sexism as being responsible for their for the fact that you hurt them. Instead, it's important for us to say, I'm sorry, I did that. And to look inward, to first think what our role is when somebody expresses that hurt. Because rather than polishing off our debate skills by saying, well, the definition of sexism is in the Webster's Dictionary or something along
the
those lines.
The white male dictionary?
Oh. Yes.
Can I add something to that? And it may be difficult for you to respond in that way if the other person who's accusing you of that has done it vehemently. Like, that was real fucking fucked up. Really, and so you might not think to respond in a calm, thoughtful, introspective.
You might get defensive.
You might not.
Listen twice as much as you speak.
And try humility for a second. If someone says you're being racist or sexist, maybe be humble. You made a mistake, maybe.
And that's the key about It's not necessarily that you're a bad person, that you're, you know, that this is a place to go into like shame. It's about relearning interaction, right? We've learned these fucked up ways of interacting with each other in this society, and that we really have to relearn a different way of being. Oh, and we've got like 15 minutes. I want to kind of like go through this real quick, and then we can, if we have time, we'll let
testify to that too. Like, sometimes it's out of ignorance. You know, for instance, like a year ago, for the longest, I was using the B words against females. I didn't know it was misogynist. I didn't know it was misogynist. I was just a kid that was using it because everybody used it. But finally, once I learned it, I was like, you're a really fucked up person. Sometimes it's out of ignorance, and sometimes instead of like snapping on a person for it, using it, like sometimes it's better to educate them.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, if people are accusing you, I mean, there's exceptions to this, and I'm not going to go into that, but, you know, if someone's accusing you of being a racist, sexist, ageist, whatever ist you are, then that's because they're probably hurt by something that you said or did. And so it's looking at, you know, talking to the person like, how do you feel, like, how are you, please tell me how you're feeling about what I said.
That's acknowledging that they're feeling.
I'm going to acknowledge that she's feeling something. I don't know exactly what it is, but I want to know what you're feeling by my doing something racist or sexist. And then And then it's like, what do you need? What can I do differently? Or what, you know, do you want me to go away? You know, whatever it is that person needs. So that you're paying attention. And they may make a request that you just can't honestly do, and that's fine. I mean, a request is not a demand, right? So, and that person, you know, that's the two sides, right? If she makes a demand of me, then and I can't respond, then that's not on me, right? But if she makes a request and I can't do it either, you know, it's like, you may not be able to do what that person wants, but at least you've had that interchange, you observed how it's gone.
They haven't been dismissed.
They haven't been dismissed, they get acknowledged, they're being heard. And that's really what a lot of this is about. And I'll just tell you that the exercise we originally planned to do was have each of you pair up and talk about a time when you were really hurt and no one would listen to you. And the idea is that, like, how does that make you feel? And think about how you felt when somebody didn't listen to you. And then think about, well, if somebody's telling you you're sexist or racist and you're not listening to them, well, wouldn't you think that they actually feel the same sort of way? I mean, we all have the same emotional complexities. And how would you respond? I mean, do you get angry? I know when people piss me off, I get angry. I have to go and like yell and scream and punch a wall or something. I need to punch it back actually. But you know, it's not surprising if a person of color is gonna get fucking angry if they're feeling oppressed by white people. I mean.
Actually, if you want to know the truth of it, they're not going to act like that. White people act like that.
That's right.
Black people are going to go away because if they act like that, they're in trouble.
Yeah.
That's just the reality of it. They can't act out. White people can act out and get away with it. And I've heard people say, well, I can do that. I'm white.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's just for real. That's just for real. Black people can't act out.
But I do know that it happens in this party.
Yeah.
People of color are more willing to speak up.
Okay.
So we've created space.
But they suffer the consequences for it too.
Sometimes that's what I'm getting at. Like that
we still
whole
need to work to make
idea
that,
of
that
like,
space.
Oh, you can't be angry because, you know, we're peace loving hippies or whatever people want to call us. And that's where this all comes back, right? If we're in this movement together, then we need to recognize and acknowledge the feelings of everybody that's here. And we need to carry that outside. And that's gonna help us actually create this world that we wanna create. And
we need to be able to communicate with each other the way we're doing here. And nobody be in fear of saying really what's happening with them and what's on their mind, what's in their heart. We need to be able to feel comfortable enough with each other that we can speak to each other and not see color. You know, that we feel each other's soul. Not. I don't see your skin. I don't see your skin. I don't see you kissing another man and just have some, you know, what I'm trying to say is, it's not, it's that we are a human being, we all bleed the same color, and we all feel pain, we all gotta eat, we all take a shit, you know, we need to think of each other on that level, you know, it's just that raw, it's just that raw, that we're really not that different.
I mean, if you were to do like a Venn diagram of different attributes, overwhelmingly we would all share most of the same attributes. And we recently did a thing for that about privilege, about like, I'm a white, cisgender male. I'm at the top of that kind of pyramid. So it's incumbent upon me to take that privilege and use it to embolden and enable others to have that safe space and have that voice.
Right. There are spaces that like you and I have easier access to, where people are more likely to listen to our voices, and we need to expand the safe space so that it can be more diverse.
We were.
It looks like the white people here are the ones doing all the talking as well.
My apologies.
No, I'm just saying, we need to notice that. I'm doing it too.
Say something.
Okay.
Because we feel comfortable.
Well, I have an interesting point of view on this, because I'm IT. And IT is being threatened a lot. And it's hard to explain how to defend a profession, because it's higher than my sex or my race. I'm talking about the whole, what I've learned since I was 7. And when it gets to the point where I'm requesting Greens, like, hey, can we elect IT people? Can we put them on the ballot? Can we have the public protect us so we don't have to run to Russia, plead the fifth over email servers, or get shot in the middle of the street at 4 o'clock in the morning? And that has nothing to do with race, sex, or anything. I'm talking about the whole entire profession of IT. And how do we approach this constitutionally for the American Green Party? Because we're dealing with the global language. Mm-hmm. Our language is global. We're the Green Party is the only party that can really address this because we're a global party. So, where's the big hoopla on transparency? You know what all of my greenies tell me? You know, you should run. And I'm like, I don't have the position to run for. It doesn't exist. I'm trying to run to make my position exist. But, oh, that's what IT people do. We create our own titles all the time.
That's funny professions.
But the history of it, where Bobbitt ran with Anita for Ohio governor, he looked it up too, and he was like, well, you know, we came up with the county clerks and the county coroners and the county prosecutors, you know, because of the mafia. And I was like, well, there's a lot of mafia stuff going on right now with IT people, so maybe we're just repeating history. And I hope I'll just keep spreading the word, like, IT people need help, because we're back in the server rooms and in the basements, and as a black woman, first of all, it's very easy to knock us off. They can hide behind the racism, they can hide behind the sexism, it can be a whole bunch of things that kill me besides what I do on the database.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Thank you very much for having courage to say that. You know where you are. That's very courageous of you to say so.
As we get near the end, I'd like to invite, there have been a lot of people who haven't really gotten a way in. I'd like to invite some reflections from some of the folks who haven't had an opportunity to speak up. If anybody would like to.
Oh, well.
This guy in the corner, too.
Oh, yeah.
I came into the Green Party a long time ago, and I thought, you know, I'm just another white guy, you know. And then I sort of realized that some things happened differently for me. But I remember when we had our convention in Wisconsin, and they put forward on everything, you know. And forward, you know, it's like we like to think we're moving forward together. In San Jose, we have this thing we call Bike Party. And basically, what it is once a month, everybody's invited, and we all have a bike party. And it's like there's a lot of diversity. It's probably a little heavy on Latinos compared to everybody else, but that's who San Jose is Latino, you know. But you know, when you have like 3,000 of your closest friends and we're all pedaling under our own power, I call that moving forward together, you know? And it's a beautiful thing, you know? And it's like everything's all volunteer. And it's a lot more post-racial than most of the things I've seen. That's all I want to say. And it's not that race doesn't exist. It's that it's kind of like it's like a fun game, you know? Because, like, part of being Latino...
I don't know that it's a fun game to be in a position of oppression.
Yeah,
these
no,
oppressed
but
statuses are not... They're not debate points.
You're
not
letting
they,
me
they,
finish.
They have very real consequences.
Talking about the bike race.
He's talking about the bike race.
I'm talking about, like part of the Latino thing is to make everything into a joke, you know? So, like, those poles on the bike trail that keep the cars from going down the bike trail, you know, that's a Pollock right there, you know? It's like a pole joke, you know? But it's like a metaphor for fair law-abiding things is like street stoplights, you know? It's red for everybody, it's green for everybody. And we all want to obey the law because being a law-abiding citizen is a good thing, you know, and that's where we start building from.
So you're